Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, and welcome to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with the fellas of Huertas, a wonderful new Basque restaurant in the East Village, Jonah Miller and Nate Adler. Thank you for being in studio. So I was lucky enough to be invited to one of the preview Asturian, is that how you say it? Cider House dinners. It's like a family style, you know, like large plate dinner, a few courses. Lots and lots of cider, which was wonderful. Homemade vermouths, which I think is the best deal in New York right now. I mean, I was so blown away, not just with the quantity of food and beverage hitting the table, but the quality and thoughtfulness and just overall sense of a complete meal. Now, you're two New York boys. Am I correct about that?
Yep.
What are you doing cooking Basque cuisine?
We grew up in the city, and I, in a sense, grew up cooking. I mean, always being drawn to food, but started working in kitchens when I was 14. And at that time, this was about 12, 13 years ago, Spain was at the forefront of modern cooking. And that was a little bit baffling that we in New York were years behind the things that they were doing in Spain. So I was intrigued by the modern cooking in Spain. Then in college, studied abroad in Madrid, and that sort of cooking was sort of unattainable and unaffordable for a college student. So I wound up eating at the typical local pincho spots and tapas spots, and realized we didn't have a lot of this in New York. And cooking in Italian restaurants here in New America, and realizing that we didn't necessarily need what would we add to the New York dining scene by opening another one of those restaurants. But really, there was a void in bringing Spain back to New York. And certainly there are Spanish restaurants in New York and some very good ones, but we wanted to push the boundaries a little more of bringing a sense of Spain, what it feels like to dine in Spain and to sit at a table in Spain or mill about in a bar. And hopefully we're offering a transporting experience to our guests.
Absolutely. And I'm not saying that you guys are childish in any way, but you are young. You are under 30. And there's this, sense of childlike fun that happens at Huertas. There's this, you guys are very dedicated people, but there's this look and feel that only someone so enthralled and so excited and has, the heart of a child can actually recreate. It's a business, but it's not business oriented.
Yeah. So I think when we traveled to Spain and I had an opportunity to go there about a couple of years after Jonah did, and take a look at what's going on out there. And Jonah had an idea to bring the pincho bars of San Sebastian and Bilbao to New York City. So we wanted to translate that to an authentic experience in New York. But the problem was, in Spain, you went up to the bar and the pinchos actually sat there. You would grab them off the tray at the bar, and then you would tell the barman at the end of your meal, well, I had three of these, and they'd charge you for it. Well, in New York City, that's a little bit difficult to execute.
You don't believe in the honor system here?
Yeah, well, the honor system is not so honorable in New York City, I'd say. And so what we did to try to translate that into a more youthful approach was take what we had experienced as children growing up in New York, eating dim sum all the time, and then some of the guys out in San Francisco, like State Bird for Provisions, that had done that with other cuisines than Chinese food, and bring that experience to the guest table side. So we have a little scorecard on the tables. We bring the pinchos around, as we call it, dim sum style, or we call them past pinchos. And every night you get to have a choice of eight of those, and a young woman or gentleman will come over and give you an opportunity to see all of them before you choose which ones you'd like.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about growing up in New York and eating in the way that you did, because we kind of glossed over that. Because, Jonah, you said you started working in kitchens at, what, 14?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think certainly I was lucky to know what I wanted to do at that point and also be in the right place to attack that. You know, I also fell into the right places. I was 13, and so was my closest friend at the time, who was actually the connection between Nate and I as well. He grew up in the same building as Nate, and for his bar mitzvah, he'd gotten a gift card to eat at Chanterelle. So we had dinner at Chanterelle. We were both still 13 at the time, and certainly wasn't typical for them to have two 13-year-old boys sitting down for dinner at one of the best restaurants in the country, really, at that time. So they, you know, asked what we were doing there. We explained that at that time the Food Network was really taking off, and you know, certainly those were the programs we watched. We explained that we liked to cook, and they invited us to look at the kitchen. So David Waltuck, the chef and owner, and his wife Karen showed us around the kitchen, and we wrote back after the meal saying, "Thanks so much. Is there any way we could actually intern here over the summer?" Or for whatever reason, it's usually called extern in kitchens, I guess, because it's usually the last part of a cooking school program. But at any rate, we spent two summers cooking there. So that's how I first got into kitchens. It's a pretty unusual place to start. I mean, it makes sense that the better the restaurant, the more in need they are of free labor and some hands to do easy tasks. But starting there at very high-end cooking, but also in a very relaxed environment, a sort of family-run environment, where volume was never the priority, was sort of the right nurturing place. If you start in the wrong place, you're not going to continue on that track.
Yeah, I mean, David Waltuck is such a kind and soft-spoken person. I mean, I can see him endearing himself more so to, you know, someone that didn't go to cooking school or someone at that age rather than, you know, a seasoned veteran, a professional that's kind of floated around. It's funny to take that and then look at Nate, who in college started his own business venture, his first, all about deliverable foods.
Yeah, sure. So I guess I took a different track than Jonah did to this business, but we're coming together at the right time. And what happened for me was that I was in business school, undergraduate in Philadelphia, and all of my friends in the school were going towards finance and consulting, which was the natural trajectory of any student at that time. And I took an internship doing that same thing and found myself back in New York City where I grew up and having a little bit more time to go out to eat here when I was an adult and survey the dining scene. And I actually took a notebook with me when I went out to eat. I started reading. I read Danny Meyer's Setting the Table. I read Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential, and started to think about it a little bit more seriously, realizing that if I was going to do something in business, I'd like to do something that I was passionate about. And I actually was cooking more of a hobby than Jonah from a young age. In fact, when Jonah and his best friend Nat, who are mutual connection, they had a catering company together in high school. Is that correct, Jonah?
Yeah, we did a wedding out here in Bushwick in high school for 120 people or so. So that I'm surprised people trusted us to do that.
You know, I parlayed my bar mitzvah into an acoustic electric guitar and a crappy high school band, and you got a career out of yours.
Well, it might have led to, you know, spawn some interest for you as well.
Yeah.
So in the catering company, I guess you could call it, I did a stage a couple of times, and they had me chopping vegetables and experienced what it meant to really cook with some amateur professionals at the time. And so when I was home for that summer and looking around and taking restaurants a lot more seriously, I went back to school and found myself a professor that was willing to sponsor an independent study for me. And what came of that was actually the idea to build a business plan and financial model for a new business on the school's campus. And the business model was sort of the food truck model, except without the actual truck. So we found a proprietary kitchen, I hired a chef. Everything happened to come together. And next thing you know, we actually opened a business that was delivering home-cooked meals to college students that were wholesome and reminiscent of mothers and fathers cooking, which is really what college kids want, not pizza and chicken wings and bagels every day.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing how ahead of the game you were. And you see a couple of these things, like Quincible, like Blue Apron, but you still have to cook them. So it's almost like taking Seamless straight from your parents' house.
Yeah, exactly.
So you should just set up this network of parents that, you know, their children have flown the coop or are no longer living at home but still want to cook family style. Just get a portion or two. And
yeah, I think it's still a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
It's something that maybe, you know, talk about future aspirations 10 years down the line. Like, yeah. Who knows what will happen. But it was a ton of fun, and it was my first foray into restaurants before I had actually ever worked in one myself. So
you read Danny Meyer's book, and you later found yourself in one of his restaurants.
That's correct.
Front of the house.
Both of us did, yeah. Actually.
And is that where you guys reconnected?
We never worked together at Union Square Hospitality Group, but certainly we were there at the same time, so there'd be opportunities to cross paths. I remember Nate had invited me as well as our friend Nat, who we've now mentioned a few times, to eat. They were doing a beer pairing dinner at Blue Smoke, and I remember, you know, I had left Maialino where I was and was working on opening Huertas, and I remember feeling as if Nate was feeling me out to see if there was an opportunity there. And I didn't really, I wasn't taking him seriously at that time. I sort of felt like, how dare this kid, is he thinking I'm going to offer him a job? But then we started talking, you know, at this point, it's certainly one of the best decisions I've made. That's when I think that the conversation started for us to do something together. And certainly sort of a shared dialogue of, sort of hospitality that we learned in that company, has been very helpful. I appreciate earlier that you said that Huertas felt like a very youthful place and energetic. And I think that's, you know, hopefully natural because we are young, but also is very, conscientious and something that we've worked towards. Coming from a Danny Meyer background, we're all about sort of building a place that feels warm and worn, and a place where, you know, you can imagine you were there 5 years ago, even though it wasn't open. And we've, you know, at times struggled, but I think improved at finding that balance between being a young new restaurant, but also becoming a warm neighborhood place. And certainly the look of the restaurant, that was one of the main things we were trying to create, is a place that doesn't seem like it's new. It doesn't feel like you're walking into a new restaurant. And we do actually have guests who come in and think that they've been there before. And then they say, yeah, years ago I came here.
Yeah, I know. I questioned myself when I introduced it as a new place in the East Village. I'm like, wait, how long has it actually been open? It's that weird New York thing, too, when something closes and something opens. You forget what was there and you forget how long what is there currently has housed, you know, that space.
Yeah, someone came in and said, I love the ribs here. And we were confused, and she said, well, I get them at takeout. So yes, the spaces blend together. I think she was thinking of Mighty Quinn's, which is a block away. But yeah, the physical spaces in New York often are long, narrow, small storefronts. And hopefully we've differentiated ourselves from the pack in the way we look, but also are happy to, you know, feel like a familiar place.
Excellent. Well, we're going to take a quick break and talk about the building blocks of Huertas, Spain, Basque Country, and our executive director, Aaron Fairbanks.
Great.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Hey, and welcome back to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here again with Jonah Miller and Nate Adler of Huertas, wonderful Basque restaurant in the East Village that has been there for a short period or a long period. We're not sure. Still,
it confuses us as well. It feels like the longest and shortest 10 months of my life. Yeah. For sure.
Let's talk about our executive director, Erin Fairbanks, and her influence on you.
Yeah, so I... the first station I ever worked and was ever trained on was by Erin, a young cook. And I'd worked in kitchens at Chanterelle and actually Gramercy Tavern and a place called Nispatan, but never sort of held down a station. So I guess I was probably about 18 at this point and working at Savoy. And Erin was a cook there and trained me and did I think she did a strong job, and, you know, it's all about accountability, and she definitely held me accountable. And she had come from, you know, a really interesting background of working at Zingerman's, and you know, it was just the right amount of the balance of patience and also aggressiveness when necessary. But I remember those days fondly.
Excellent. It's all connected in some way.
It is. I mean, we are lucky sort of have a place now where people can come visit us, because there's so many people who, you know, we've learned from, and now they know where, if they want to say hi, where to find us.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about those people you learned from in Spain. I mean, there were some transformative trips there that you guys took together, and that impetus, that what was that point where you're like, it is the Cider House, it is these kind of dinners, these large format, you know, multi-course things that people sit together and share, this is what I want to do at Huertas.
Well, I think one thing is that we have never been to Spain together and still need to do that. But again, you know, the experience that we felt was maybe missing in New York, or we could add to the scene, was more of the cultural, social experience of dining there. So pinchos, tapas bars, standing milling about, that's certainly, you know, the most unique part of their culture. But the other side of it, you know, as many cultures do, or have occasions to sit down and have feasts, essentially. And, you know, it's more exciting for us to be able to offer more than one thing under the roof of Huertas. And really, that's been a challenge as well, because we do pinchos and we have a tasting menu that changes quite regularly in our back dining room. So this is adding a third layer, but really, it now almost is three restaurants, and people can come three times in a week and have a completely different, you know, the food. Sure, there'll be some reminiscent bites, but more than the food being different, which it is, this sort of story that we're telling and the experience they're having is completely different with each meal.
So what kind of story are you trying to tell with this northern region of Spain? Let's first talk about the wines and ciders, which are just so distinct and so refreshing.
Yeah, so the wines and the beverage culture in northern Spain in general is one of distinction. It's something that the flavors are so unique. It's something that you can't find anywhere else, and that's sort of what I sell tableside almost every night. I think the fact that we have, you know, 8 ciders by the bottle on our list, that we have 5 different chacolis, which is the indigenous wine of the Basque region, and then a wide array of Galician wines and Asturian. We even have an Asturian wine, which is very rare. Lots of wines from Catalunya, but in general, the beverage culture is so unique in Spain, across Spain. We make one exception to go south of Madrid when we go into Sherry country in Andalusia. But there's something about it that's just, it takes the influence from the sea, whether you're drinking an Albariño from Rías Baixas, or you're drinking a Sherry from Jerez, or you're drinking a Chacolí from the Basque country. There's something about the salinity, about the mouth-watering aspect to it that just goes so well with food. And I think the best way to experience Spanish beverage is actually to share it. It's not to have, you know, a glass of this and a glass of that, but to have a bottle of cider hit the table while you're eating a slow roasted chicken, or to have a bottle of chacolí that gets poured from above your head and starts to sparkle, because it's all part of an experience. And I think that that's what you try, when you're creating a restaurant, what you're trying to do is create something that's experiential. And with these large format dinners, that's exactly what we were going for, which was to recreate these experiences that we had traveling across Spain, and pair them with something not just that's family and company, but actually beverage and alcohol and that aspect of it and the service part of it too, which I think is different than other restaurants that are providing large format experiences. I think rarely do you go to a restaurant and you get something in the middle of the table plus some cider or plus some wine. And I think, you know, we've tried to push the envelope with that as much as we can with our tasting menu as well, where we provide beverage pairings with every course.
There's never five glasses of wine for our pairings. I mean, I think that's exciting for us to have sherry, to have cider, and Huertas means orchard. For us, the north of Spain makes a lot more sense in New York than the south, and I think often people think of, when you think of Spain, you think of the south. You think of bullfighting and sherry and olives, and I think a lot of that Moorish Arabic influence and the sort of dry dehesa. But the north looks a lot like the northeast of the U.S. and the products and the ocean. There are a lot of tie-ins, and apples being, to me, the biggest one. Asturias, all you see is apples. And as Nate was saying, we have an Asturian wine now, which is quite unusual. I think there's only six or seven producers in Asturias because all they drink is cider. And, you know, that's what we drank here for generations. And I don't think we can take any credit for helping to bring sherry back, because that was underway. But hopefully we're part of that movement to have not just serious cider from Spain, which has really just come to the U.S. in the last couple of years, but also bringing back great American cider. And there's so many producers, who have, like a dairy farm, if you realize you have milk and cows, let's try making cheese. There's so many people who grow apples now that everyone's starting to make cider, and there's some really great ones. But so Huertas, I lived on Calle de la Huertas in Madrid, so that was sort of where the name came from, but also the north versus the south. The south is agriculture, large format farming. There's an expression in the north, which is called Green Spain, that everyone has their huertas, sort of the back 40 acres. Everyone has a little garden, a little patch, orchard behind their house. There aren't these big farms. And there are also more cities. It's closer to the rest of Europe. It's more cosmopolitan, and certainly, you know, San Sebastian and Barcelona, to be honest, don't feel as much like being in Spain to me as they do being in Europe. Madrid is more quintessential Spain. When you're in San Sebastian or Barcelona, you can walk a few blocks without hearing anyone speak Spanish. Lots of different languages. And I think, Galicia and Santiago de Compostela are really as much responsible for the food and beverage as anywhere in the Basque Country. But for us, the connection that the whole world has with Basque food, and this idea of really they take food more seriously there, as seriously as anywhere in the world, and it's a little bit easier to tell the story just about Basque food, but to us it's a little bit broader than just that.
The dishes that you have on the Cider House dinners, obviously serious technique, serious product, but it's light and playful food at the same time too. The asadillo, I think, is the first dish that hits a table. Can you talk about that dish specifically, and maybe the progression of what happens during these dinners?
Yeah, I think that's one of the fun things for us, and for me especially, is that we're not experts in Spanish food necessarily. We're becoming experts, but I knew more about Italian food going into this than Spanish, certainly. So it's a lot more rewarding to open a place, maybe not for our guests per se, but something I've come to learn is, what excites us, what excites me, is going to trickle down and have the best results for the restaurant. So in having a restaurant where we're able to every day learn about a new dish or discover a new dish, and it doesn't mean that we're necessarily going to even eat that dish in Spain, but to open a vintage Spanish cookbook and stumble across something. So the asadillo is something that Nate actually had when he was in Spain. I think when you're at Casamingo in Madrid, which is an Asturian spot.
So when I was in Madrid, I guess, researching and vacationing, one of my former classmates in high school actually is living in Madrid. And I hit her up on Facebook and I was like, hey, Daphne, is there anything I should see out here? Do you want to hang out? And she was so delighted to have somebody from New York come visit. And she showed me around the town, took me to only Sherry Bar, took me to a couple of different cocktail bars just so I could get my bearings and actually help me work through the beverage program at Huertas before I had even stumbled upon any Spanish literature on that subject. And she took me to a place called Casamingo, which was an Asturian restaurant in Madrid. And what they have in the traditional fashion is slow roasted or spit roasted chicken. And really all the only other thing that they serve there is house made sausages and this dish called asadillo and some cheese and meats. But this dish was basically ventresca, which is tuna belly that they make with in a salad with soft boiled eggs and olives and this relish of piquillo peppers and onions. And I presented that as something that I thought would be really cool to go with Asturian cider house dinners, and Jonah embraced that and then made it his own.
Yeah, but we've tweaked a little bit. I think it's heavy food in that part of the world, and that was when we wanted to lighten up to start the meal. So instead of having tuna belly, we have house smoked trout and and some pickled onions and olives, and then as well take the after we smoke the trout, we take the skin and dry it out and then fry it. So there's these chips to...
It's one of my favorite. I mean, I love that texture of crispy fish skin, but it felt so Ashkenazi. So appetizing shop of the Lower East Side.
Yeah, if there weren't a slew of other people opening that kind of place right now, we would be enticed because, you know, we grew up on the Upper West Side of New York, of Manhattan. So we're quite familiar with the Zabar's... Fairway Citarella scene.
Yeah. Another what seems like common dish, tortilla espanol, is neither a tortilla nor an omelet. It's
well, it's so tortilla, and this is a sort of thing that, you know, less so, but we have sort of an obligation to educate our guests on the difference between Latin food and Spanish food and to sort of help steer away from that confusion. But the one thing they do have in common is the shape. And I think they both come from torta, which is like cake. So they're both round, and that's where the name derives from. But it's not a Latin-style tortilla. And it's most like a frittata, I would say. And I think the biggest difference between that and a frittata is in Spain. And even now, it's quite unusual for ovens to be in homes. So it's something that traditionally is cooked on a stovetop, and actually is a bit tricky, technically speaking, because you cook halfway and then flip it onto a plate and slide it back into the pan. And to be perfectly honest, we don't do that at Huertas. It's kind of a pain in the ass, and it's messy, and you're going to have plates covered in runny eggs all over the kitchen. And we have modern conveniences like combination ovens where you can set a certain amount of steam and dry heat and make a damn good tortilla like that.
Yeah.
And that's a dish also we, you know, they're... Our restaurants that serve it just as we do or close to it in Spain, but more often than not in Spain, it's a huge omelet that's made once or twice a day in a restaurant and sits out at a bar in room temperature and inherently is quite dry and filled with lots and lots of potatoes because that's something you can slice and it's not going to run out. The eggs won't run out. Hopefully they'll run out of product and make a fresh one. But we serve ours fresh and a la minute, and it is runny. And hopefully you break into it and it's sort of oozing and custardy.
Yeah, plus as a restaurateur in New York, we have something called DOH, where, you know, you have to tweak these ideas and these you know, recipes every once in a while to be compliant. But yes. I love the personalized aspect of getting, you know, that cast iron at the table, tortilla española, right there. And just
In much the same way that you can't have a meal in, you know, much of, if not all of Asia without a bowl of rice, the Spanish table's incomplete without a tortilla. I mean, we're going to switch the large format dinners that we do, and it's quite possible that, you know, tortilla will stick around for most of them because it really is the most commonly eaten food in Spain, along with jamon. But, you know, they're not eating paella every day.
So obviously, this meal would be incomplete without, how do you say it, fabada.
Fabada.
But my life was also incomplete until fabada.
So this is how I can tell if someone knows what they're talking about. The chicken, it's good chicken. Certainly, it's really good chicken. But, you know, there are quite a few places that serve good chicken in New York. The more exciting part of this meal is the fabada. And it's beans, which might not be exciting. But we make the chorizo that goes into it. We make the bacon that goes into it. And we make the morcilla, the blood sausage. So from our perspective, you know, when we send that dish out, there's a lot more work that goes into it. And, you know, it's more of an achievement, so to speak, to hopefully have, you know, I think we're making some of the best chorizo that I've had. And the morcilla is, this is the first time that I ever made morcilla. It was for this dinner. And this is a very typical Asturian morcilla, which is atypical in that it's onions. It's mostly onions.
Yeah. And morcilla is blood sausage.
So it is. Not... Mm-hmm, and there's blood sausage all over the world. Yeah. And even within Spain, there's many types of blood sausage. In the south, you'd see it with lots of rice. And rice is grown in the south of Spain, not in the north. But in Asturias, it's almost 10 parts onions to blood. 10 parts onion, 1 part blood. So it really is sort of a starter blood sausage. It's sweet and mild and, you know, really rounds out these beans, which, you know, beans are a vehicle to eat these delicious sausages.
Yeah, and they are delicious, and I've had lots of different blood sausages around the world, from morcillas to, you know, black puddings. And what was so great about this one, I think, was the texture. You know, usually it's compounded with rice and gets a little dry and gritty, like you were explaining, you know, tortillas. But this one just was so much more lush and, like, the perfect amount of warming spices. It just was such a heartwarming dish.
The warming spice is interesting. I was just reading about the dish and how it was first served or first written about when the Asturians were the people, because all the regions of Spain were different kingdoms at that time that defeated the Moors as they were approaching in 711. But all those warming spices are inherently Moorish influence. So I guess they, you know, defeated them, but then took the influence of some of the cinnamon and cloves that they, you know, would have brought to that part of the world.
We were talking about chocolate, and I don't want to, you know, not talk about the performative aspect again, pouring from up high so it aerates. I kind of liken it to the keg stand of wines because it kind of, it's one of those takes a village to actually, you know, take part in. But you were also pouring one of my favorite one. What is it? The Isategui?
Isategui, yeah. So that's a Basque cider.
Yeah.
And they actually pour cider and chocolate in the same fashion because it's naturally fermented. The apples are in the Spanish and Basque style cider. So literally what they do is they take apples and they let them rot and then they press them and put them into a bottle. So there's no secondary fermentation like there is in a lot of American ciders. And as a result, it's still. That being said, because of the sort of funkiness of it, in order to make it more palatable, they pour it from a high point in order to spur up these bubbles. And the idea is actually that they want you to shoot it. So you're supposed to pour 2 ounces, you shoot it, and then you pour another 2 ounces so that it's fresh and bubbly when you drink
it. And you, meaning us and not the guests. I mean, but in Spain, they don't let you pour your own cider. You have to watch the bottle on the table and look at the server and hope that they come over and pour you your next sip.
Yeah.
But it really, it's theatrical. You know, it looks, you're at a bullfight. You know, they turn their back to you, they look away from the glass, and they spill half the cider on the floor, but it's so dirt cheap over there. I don't know if I ever told you this. Before we opened, I got coffee with a third generation of the Asphalt cider family, English cider. You were saying how they just let the apples rot. So he was an expert on cider, and we're talking about Spanish cider. And he sort of admired the product, but said, you know, it's sort of frustrating for them. They work hard to, like, craft a palatable cider. The Spanish just let it rot. There's nothing involved. There's no process. You know, the people, they're not doing anything, so it's almost unfair. You know, their style is to let it rot, and we've spent generations trying to make a balanced, you know, I think, sweet cider. But it really is something that is quite unusual, and, you know, for us, very fun to serve because it's not what people expect. It's not woodchuck cider.
Yeah.
I also think it's really cool to see how things have transformed since we opened in terms of beverage. And I remember very vividly at the beginning when we were opening the restaurant and tasting hundreds of wines and ciders while the site was under construction on a piece of cardboard when it was freezing cold out. And John was like, we need to have cider. We need to have cider. We need to have a lot of cider. And I was like, questioning him as to whether New Yorkers would get around to it. And I think we hit it at just the right moment because there's this new resurgence of cider. It's actually the largest growing sector in the alcohol industry right now, to my knowledge. That and things like fortified wines, which we're also doing a lot of in the restaurant. And we started out with five ciders on our list, and then it started to grow, and we started to change them. We started to put them on the pairing in the tasting menu, and now it's, you know, the main event along with the fabata and the chicken in these large format dinners, and it's something that we want to continue to grow and nurture as an area of that beverage list.
Yeah, I mean, I think doing the chicken dinner, the fabata, like, a lot of the impetus was we wanted to highlight cider and also highlight a region of northern Spain that wasn't the Basque country to show sort of there's a lot more to Spain, I mean, to the north than San Sebastian and Pinchos. And I think, you know, in the future, the large format meals could certainly head a little further west to Galicia. And there's a lot of sort of unexplored territory in the sense of what's being served in New York.
Yeah, and there's a lot more to you guys than your young age. There's such maturity in not just the way you speak about, you know, the conceptualization of Huertas, but of that region of exploring and progressing this cuisine to a point where 10 months will seem like nothing.
I think that is, you know, one of the reasons that we're doing Spanish is this opportunity to kind of be a flag bearer, to be, you know, sure, sometimes I feel like a fraud because I speak Spanish only okay, and guests will come from Spain and come up to the pass and want to chat with me, and sometimes I know what they're talking about and sometimes I don't, but you know, regardless of how well we speak Spanish and how much time we've spent there, I think we really are adding a bit of Spain that, or, you know, is still hard to find in this country.
Yeah. I'm also glad that, you know, these dinners happens on Wednesday nights, correct? That you're adding another day. Sunday reservations will soon be available.
Yeah, so we're going to be opening actually 7 days a week starting on February 8th. We found that, you know, in that neighborhood in the East Village, there's an opportunity, especially with all the industry people that we've seen coming by that say, hey, you know, my days off are Sunday, Monday, and this is the only day off I had, so I came by, and we want to be able to turn it into a space where industry people can come and have these large format experiences every Sunday night, and come in Monday night for a tasting menu as well. And we're really excited to be opening our doors for another couple of days.
And I think I've always liked places that do a Sunday supper. I think it's a really nice idea of, like, here's a simple, straightforward, something I can go, you know, there's been many a Sunday where at 2 p.m. I'm talking to my parents, what should we do tonight? Like, we don't want a long tasting menu, or we don't want to trek out to Flushing, but what can we do that would be, you know, simple and fun? And, you know, this, when we started doing this a few weeks ago, it felt natural. Like, when we open Sunday, this is what we have to do Sunday. It'll be, you know, the perfect balance of fun and simple, and, you know, certainly meant to bring a group together. And I think 4 to 6 is achievable. You know, it's not like a large front where you have to have 10 people to come to do the dinner.
And I don't normally talk about the economics of dining out, but this is a steal. I mean, this is one of the best deals in New York right now. How much does it cost for 4 to 6 people to be fed?
So it's $150 for up to 6 people, with 2 bottles of cider currently. So you get all the chicken, enough to feed 6 with the asadillo, tortilla, and fabada, 2 bottles of cider for $150. As we expand into other large format experiences, it might fluctuate a little bit here or there, but the idea is really to have people come in and have that really valuable experience and feel like they left, you know, full and satisfied and happy.
Yeah, and to be perfectly frank, on Wednesdays we're offering it at 6:30 and 9:30, so we're not you know, offering it at 8 p.m. at the center of dinner service, and hopefully it's an opportunity for us to pass some value on to guests who can join us at the beginning of the evening or at the end of the evening when, you know, we might have a table that's not filled. And, you know, we're not the first ones to use that model. I think Momofuku up the street has been doing it for years quite successfully. So in a lot of ways, this is one of the more unoriginal things that we've done. We're taking a meal from Asturias. So we're not creating it necessarily. And the idea of large format, you know, we didn't create that either, but, you know, we're very comfortable with the idea of it not being creative. There's nothing wrong with that. This is something we're sort of taking some tried and true practices and just honing them and making them our own.
It's wonderful to see at your young age, too, that you have humility. So thank you for that. And if you haven't booked your dinners at Huerta's, jump on Wednesdays and now Sundays. Just a wonderful meal all around. Thank you, Jonah. Thank you, Nate. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.